Greetings, Chicagoland. Thank you for tuning in to the weekly program, Building Community, Strengthening Nations, based on improving lives through public service and volunteerism. Today's presentation is brought to you by the Forum to Achieve Altruism, Compassion, and Tolerance, the FACT organization, with more than a 75-year legacy of promoting peace, harmony, equality, and social justice for all. Building Community, Strengthening Nations features newsmakers and movers and shakers engaged in enlightening discussions on current issues and events that positively impact our diverse communities. The FACT organization invites you to contact us for general information or referral services, volunteer opportunities, and suggestions, questions, or comments regarding programming topics and guests. Please call FACT at 773-424-8002 to reach our 24-hour voicemail and facsimile. Our email address is faactorg@aol.com. Now tell your friends to tune in to FACT every Tuesday evening at 7:30 p.m. We're streaming live over the internet at www.thechicagolighthouse.org. My name is Ruth M. Fairfax Frazier. I am the founder and executive director of the FACT organization, and today I am so pleased to serve as your host. FACT is always excited about this opportunity to share time with you, our most valued listening public, with different weekly topics of interest that positively influence our communities. However, as we always say, this can only be accomplished with your help. The fact is, we all need each other, and by uniting our efforts, we can make a positive difference for everyone. In a nutshell, FACT's combined vision and mission is to help create a better world through educating the public and coalescing with others to eradicate biases and prejudices, as well as hate crime.
As I walk through this world, nothing can stop a duke of earth. And you are my girl, and no one can hurt you. Oh no, yes I Duchess.
Greetings, everyone. I'm Ruth Fairfax Frazier with the FACT organization, bringing you Building Community, Strengthening Nations here on Chris Radio. And we'd like to interrupt whatever you're doing because we have a very esteemed guest joining us today, Mr. Gene Chandler, the Duke of Earl. Welcome to the program, sir.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
And we are so fortunate to have two co-hosts joining us also. We have Tamiko Dixon, the granddaughter of the blues and nominee, who is a consummate volunteer. She helps us here at Chris Radio and also with the Chicago Lighthouse. Welcome, ladies, to the program.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
We're going to start off by nominee, you telling us a little bit about yourself and introducing our guests.
Absolutely, thank you. I have a background in theater acting from Columbia College Chicago, full scholarship. I moved to Los Angeles shortly after and became involved with NARAS, the National Association of Recording Industry Professionals, and joined as a voting member and did some independent study in music business. I actually promoted Rob Jones, who is total blind and was a patron of the Chicago Lighthouse when his incident first occurred around 1993. So I'm very honored to be here to learn from the best.
And of course, we want everyone to tune in to Miss Tomiko Dixon.
Hey everybody, I'm back and I brung the Duke of Earl. Yes, we're having his street naming on October the 3rd on 5900 block of Racine. So if you're here in Chicago, come on out and join us and let's celebrate the Duke, you guys.
All right. Well, let's start off, Duke, with you telling us about your background. Let's start with childhood.
Childhood.
Where was that at?
In Chicago. I was born and raised in Chicago, of course. And it started off on the east side. I think I lived between, it was 429 East 46th Place. It's not there anymore, but that was between Vincent and, at that time, South Park, which is now King Drive. And I guess I lived there and from birth until I was 12 years old. Then I moved to Inglewood. Which is where we're going to have our street name, and I guess we'll talk about that later.
All right. Well, who were some of your mentors when you were growing up?
Oh, well, singing or...
In life.
Oh, gosh. I don't know if I really had any mentors as a child, except for, like all other kids, I liked those cowboys like Roy Rogers and Hopalong Cassidy, and those kind of things. But as far as people who I converse with, it was just a variety of people in the neighborhoods. You know, some of the older people trying to tell us how to run our lives and what to do and that kind of thing.
And it was good advice. Straight and narrow for a little time.
Yeah. It was good advice.
You know. But as you moved towards music, what was the attraction for you with that? And did you have any mentors?
No, I didn't. There was certain vocalists that I admired. One group lead singer was Pookie Hudson of the Spaniards. I tried to emulate him a lot. You know, you paint the picture right from the star. Pookie Hudson. And I did a lot of that. When I went to Inglewood High School, I sung those songs. But prior to that, the first time I went on a stage and sung, I was 5 years old. And, of course, I didn't know I was going to bring the house down, but I wasn't afraid either. There was a song, why I fell in love with it, I don't know, but it was called Danny Boy. Oh, Danny Boy, the pipes are calling.
For a five-year-old, that was a challenge.
I don't know why, the sound of it or whatever, I just learned the song. My parents were playing it. And I just learned the song, and I just loved that song.
Now, so, were your parents musicians?
I'm sorry?
Were your parents musicians?
No.
So you're just a natural.
Yeah, my mother worked at R. Donnelly's, and my father worked at Inland Steel in Gary. And I was only one. I wasn't born with a silver spoon in my mouth, but we weren't poor. You know, because I had everything, you know. But anyway, they had this 4th of July picnic every year out in one of some big forest. I can't even remember where it was at. But they had this big stage, and of course it was open all on the sides, and this stage was in the middle. And my parents told me, you always singing that song, Danny Boy, why don't you go up there and sing it? And I said, okay. I wasn't afraid or nothing, you know. And I went up there and sung Danny Boy, and they was just raving and screaming and hollering, all the people and everything. So that was my first time on a stage appearing before anyone, you know.
So as you moved into high school, what happened?
Well, in high school, we formed a group called the Duques. Scratch that. Let me take it back. The Gay Tones were the name of the group. And it was a long time ago, and it was the disc jockey. His name was McKee Fitzhugh. He was on the radio, I don't remember. But whatever. He gave a citywide contest. So each school had their own private contest, and whoever won that contest from that school They then went on to do what you would call the citywide contest for all of those who had won from their school. Mm-hmm. And that group was called the Gaytones. We got called in the hall several times singing when we should have been in class.
Right.
And so at Inglewood, they told us, you might as well get in the contest, because we, the guy who used to catch us all the time, we would deny that it was us, right? Mm-hmm. So I think he was an assistant principal or something. Whatever. He put a camera around his neck. Because we kept denying it wasn't us. And he finally caught us on picture, mm-hmm. on camera. Mm-hmm. And in any event, to make a long story short, we won from Inglewood. And then they had the city contest, which was at the Trianon Ballroom.
Okay.
That was on 62nd and Cottage Grove, mm-hmm. at the time, I think. And of course, all the kids at all the high schools, they packed that place. I mean, I guess they would have closed it down if they had knew how many people were standing around and, you know, didn't have chairs. But it was a citywide situation. And to make another long story short, the Gaytones won the city.
Yay.
I remember well because I had an abscess.
Oh.
And my jaw was swollen.
Mm-hmm.
And they were saying, how are you going to go up there with your jaw swollen and you have an abscess? I say, I'm not going to miss this. We didn't okay. waited all this time, and right. we won to get here.
Right.
I'm not going to miss this. So I was trying to take pictures because everybody was taking pictures for the newspaper. I was trying to hold a side that didn't have the abscess.
But it did not affect the velvet.
No, it did not.
Voice.
We won the citywide contest.
Okay.
And then we were on the radio every Sunday for about 6 weeks. Coming out of Robbins, Illinois, at some club.
Mm-hmm.
And we were supposed to get a recording contract, but we didn't.
Okay.
But we did get the radio show, and so everybody's around the radio listening for us, and we were singing live, mm-hmm. on stage at some club or every Sunday evening, you know.
Okay.
So that was my first introduction. Now, the group that I called on first, that I told you to scratch, the Duques,
mm-hmm.
when they found out about all of this was going on, my neighborhood had a group. And they were saying, we need you to join us and sing with us because you're from this neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I eventually joined the Duques. And they were the ones that I was recording with when I recorded my first big hit. I went to the service for 3 years. I was in Airborne Rangers for 3 years. I was 17 and a half, so my mother had to sign for me. You had to be 18 to sign for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
They held on and waited for me to come back. It was about 3 months before I came home, finally from the service, that they had a recording contract. And they asked them to wait till I come back. They said, well, we picked you for the lead singer you got. They said, yeah, but you got to hear him. And we promised. And if he knew that we had a recording contract 3 months before we came home and we didn't wait, we're going to catch it from him. Okay. Anyway, I came home. Mm-hmm. They heard me do the lead singing and they liked it. And so the rest is history. We ended up recording. The first record was called The Girl is a Devil. Mm-hmm. And, and she's trying to make, that's the rest of the girl is a devil. She's trying to make a monkey out of me, but I love her so. It was big in Chicago, but not around the country.
Mm-hmm.
So eventually they got someone who could take our records nationally. And the next recording session is when we recorded Night Owl. Night Owl strolling down the street about the break of day. And it goes on. In that same session, we recorded Duke of Earl, which I wrote. I wrote it in a rehearsal. It wasn't supposed to be a song. We were only opening up our throats.
Mm-hmm.
And we were saying do. Do, just, you know, getting ready to rehearse. And we began to clown around. And the guys kept saying do. And I said to myself, we can't record a song saying do. We got, you know. So for some way, I guess by watching movies, mm-hmm. in England, and I said Duke.
Mm-hmm.
See, there's no such thing as a Duke of Earl. There's a Earl of something and a Duke of something.
Right.
But it was a guy in the group, his name was Earl, so, you know, that was, I knew it was English, that's all I knew. So there's an Earl of things and there's a Duke of different things.
Well, everyone, we opened our program with the classic song, Duke of Earl. Can you give us a couple bars?
A couple of bars?
Mm-hmm.
Duke.
Help us out a little bit more.
A little bit more?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it just goes on. Duke of Earl. If you notice, it goes up to mm-hmm. channels.
Right.
And comes back down the channels.
Mm-hmm.
We were rehearsing. Right. Anyway, we kept singing. And when they were singing, I began to put words to it. My mom came out of the kitchen, wherever she was at, and said, when did you all put that together? I said, just now. She said, that sounds good.
Mm-hmm.
And then it began to sound good to us.
Okay.
So our manager stayed about 3 blocks from my home and ran around the corner to tell her about it. And she listened. She wrote Night Owl and Girl is the Devil and other things.
Mm-hmm.
And she listened to it for about 3 times. And she said, Gene, do you mind if I put a line in there?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I was very proud of it. And I said, what line? That's my song. Anyway, the line that Bernice Williams put in the song was, we'll walk through my dukedom and paradise we will share.
Okay.
And I threw it in there and it sounded good,
mm-hmm.
you know. And of course, as time went by, I realized what I had put together.
Right.
The dukedom is my home, my house, my castle.
Mm-hmm.
And if you walk through my house with me, paradise you will share.
All right.
Okay, whatever that entails.
Okay. Well, tell us about what role Carl Davis played around that time.
Carl Davis is one of those people who waited for me to come reluctantly.
Okay.
And Bill Bunky Shepherd.
Mm-hmm.
They put the record company together. They started the record company. And they produced it,
mm-hmm.
which was their role. Okay. I didn't want to sing it at first because I wanted strings. And they could not afford strings. Matter of fact, that they sold the publishing to VJ Records of Night Owl,
mm-hmm.
in order to have the money to record us.
Okay.
Which leads to how the song came out on VJ as opposed to the Nat label, which was Carl's. And they, VJ's A&R director, Calvin Carter, wanted to hear what the Night Owl song sound like.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, oh, that's great. He said, what else did you all record? And so they played the rest of them. Of course, Duke of Earl was in there. And he said, well, who owns that? They said, well, nobody. The guy had the first right of refusal. He turned that down for Night Owl. Mm-hmm. And Calvin said, well, can we lease it or buy it? And they said, sure. You know,
mm-hmm.
Well, the problem was I had one name on the contract with the Duke Hayes. And I couldn't sign with that name with VJ.
Mm-hmm.
So Jeff Chandler was a favorite actor of mine. You might call that a mentor.
Mm-hmm.
And I chose Chandler as the last name, and I shortened Eugene to Gene.
Okay.
And that's how Gene Chandler, the Duke of Earl, was made.
Well, we should let our audience know that your birth name was Eugene Drake Dixon.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
And nominee, what questions do you have for this wonderful gentleman?
Sure. I'd like to admit wasn't very versed in all that you entail, if I can call you Mr. Chandler. So I called up a DJ friend of mine. He goes by Ray King. And he said that his collection, he has so much vinyl. And he said that his collection is very well versed. And he directed me to Rainbow 80, I believe.
Mm.
And I forgot the other one. Does She Have a Friend? Which one is it? Yeah.
That's one.
Yeah, yeah. That's one. So I listened to those two before I came down. And I really, really like what I heard. So thank you for making those and recording those for us.
Well, that's a little story behind that. Rainbow was recorded in 1963 on VJ Records. That was the original version. They didn't want to put Rainbow out. They thought it was too long before it came to a break. Written by Curtis Mayfield. And I objected to that. But they said, well, go on and record it. And that's what I did. Now, they were going after a song called You Threw a Lucky Punch, which was the answer to Mary Wells' You Beat Me to the Punch. Mm-hmm. I didn't care to answer somebody else's song, but I did the song as best as I could do it, you know. But the song, when they put it out there, it was going up the charts. But when I went out to work, I refused to sing it. I had asked them, I said, if you don't like Rainbow, then make it the B-side, okay? All I sung was Rainbow. But I won that battle because a jock in Richmond, Virginia and in Newark, New Jersey turned the song over and started playing Rainbow and the telephones lit up. And Carl Davis said, okay, I guess you were right. Rainbow is going to be the hit. Because they started playing it all across the country and everything. So I was very fortunate in that sense. Now, singing Rainbow, we developed part two because they kept hollering more. They wanted me to come back. So I was trying to figure out what I was going to say when I came back. Remember, I'm new in the business and I never, well, I've had people holler about more, but it was different with Rainbow.
Especially after Regal.
Yeah. Yes, so I went out there and started doing, and I started making up different things on the stage, and I was socking it to them, and I was doing all kind of things with it. And I developed part two. Well, 2 years later, in 1965, they recorded me live at the Regal Theater. So it was called Rain. They called me to the office and said, you got to listen to this. We want to come back with Rainbow, the live version. And so the women in the audience was hollering, you cool, daddy? And they was doing all, saying all kind of things. Look, oh, do that to me again or something. Whatever. It was exciting when you listen to the live version. So they released it as Rainbow Live 65 Part 2. Okay, from that point, it was Curtis Mayfield. It was so big, Curtis Mayfield gave me a piece of Rainbow. So I own a piece of Rainbow today, which I didn't before. From the Part 2. Now, I'm the only artist, and if you can tell me what has another one, because we thought about this over and over and over the years, that has had a hit off of his own record three different times.
Okay.
In 1980, 3 years prior to that, we were putting records that we thought from the 60s into the new album. An oldie in the new album. And somebody said, let's do Rainbow Girl. I said, man, we done had a hit off it twice. Let's don't press our luck. And so they said, we just gonna put it in there as an oldie from the 60s like we did the rest of things, like God Bless Our Love, things like that I did. So the song you just mentioned about Does She Have a Friend for Me?
Sure.
Right. That was the single they were putting out from the album. In those days, they would put the single out first and then the album would follow. Does She Have a Friend for Me was going up the charts. And it was happening. When the DJs got the album, it was entitled Rainbow 80. And so, of course, this is 15 years later, right?
Mm-hmm.
The jocks put the needle on it. That thing took off again.
Okay.
Knocked the Does She Have a Friend for Me out of the way. It shot past her.
You had a winning.
So I've had a hit off of Rainbow three times.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Well, tell us, what is the Chicago sound?
What is the Chicago sound?
Mm-hmm. And some of the players back in the day.
Well, the Chicago sound is no more than other cities have. Each city have their sound.
Right.
Like Muscle Shoals, New York, Los Angeles. Detroit,
mm-hmm.
You know, Motown was the Detroit sound.
Mm-hmm.
So we had our sound and musicians that played our stuff here in Chicago, and that was called the Chicago sound.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and of course Carl Davis named his record company Shy Sound.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. So, who were some of the artists that were very popular with you in your heyday?
Jerry Butler's, The Spaniels, The Dells, The Impressions. You know, when I went to VJ Records, when they bought the Duke of Earl record, they had never had a million seller. But the Duke turned out to be their first million seller. The closest they came to a million seller was D. Clark. He was, he did the Raindrops. So there must be raindrops falling from the sky. You know, funny thing, D. Clark was a clerk in the warehouse of VJ. And that's where they found him at. But he came closest, but 900 some thousand. But Duke of Earl took off so fast, my head was spinning.
Okay.
They're saying, we got a smash.
Okay.
And VJ was big because they had had the Impressions, the Spaniels, the Dells, Jerry Butler, Jimmy Reed in blues. And it was another guy, I can't think of his name right now. They had a gospel line. Actually, they were bigger than Motown because they had more than just the regular artists. They had blues catalog, gospel catalog, jazz catalog. So that made them really bigger than Motown. And just to jump ahead a second, when Abner sold Constellation Records, which is where Rainbow 65 was on, Motown hired him as president of Motown to run Motown. That's when the Jackson Fives came along. And he was handling Stevie Wonder and the Jackson 5, but he actually ran the company. But that's how good he was. Mm-hmm. He was innovative. Mm-hmm. Matter of fact, speaking about Abner and being innovative from Chicago, VJ Records were the first to have white artists that were hit artists on that label. And people might be surprised, because when you go and listen to this group, because they got a show out there, a Broadway show, I went to see the show and they didn't even mention VJ. But the Four Seasons' first million seller was on VJ, Sherry. Okay. Then they went on and Big Girls Don't Cry and all that. Mm-hmm. All of those hits were started at VJ.
Right here in Chicago.
Right here in Chicago. That's how the Four Seasons took off. And they also had a guy named Jimmy Clanton and another guy named Frank Ifill. These were the white artists. Mm-hmm. And before I stop on the VJ thing, the first Beatle records were bought by Hewitt Abner. Just to make it clear, when Calvin Carter wanted to buy the Duke of Earl record, he had to call to Europe. That's where Abner was making the deal for the first Beatle records with Brian Epstein, the Beatles manager. Mm-hmm. And he said, if you call me all the way to Europe for a record, just go on and buy it. You know, and of course he came home, and of course we had a hit record, so that was it. But no, Abner was very innovative and well respected around the country, and I guess that's why Motown hired him at one point. Mm-hmm. When he was available to run that company. But that's the story of VJ and some of the artists that they had. And me. Now what happened is Capitol had the money to do all of that big promotion. Mm-hmm. For the Beatles, you know, people screaming and hollering, right, at the airport, you name it,
right,
Ed Sullivan. So what VJ did, Abner was smart. Once they became a hit, people were buying anything they had, and that's when Abner released the stuff he bought.
Okay, very good.
And
very
then
good.
Capitol eventually bought it from them, from mm-hmm. Abner, later on, yeah. Mm-hmm. But that's, you know, part of my career in the beginning. Yeah.
Okay. Well, sir, I'm going to suggest that we're going to have you back on, because it is so much that we haven't even touched on about your career that we want our audience to know about.
That's true.
But there's something coming up, Ms. Nominee, if you can share it with us, a date that we want everyone to be in attendance for.
So there's a street naming on Saturday, December 3rd from 12 noon to 1 p.m. It's 5900 South Racine, of course, in Chicago. And we really, really would like it if you come out. I'm considering joining everyone and seeing familiar face myself.
Okay. And Ms. Tamika, tell us a little bit about your connection to this wonderful gentleman? I understand that you might have touched bases with him at the Grammys.
Yes, the first time I met Mr. Chandler was at the 2013 Grammys. And it was an amazing moment because it was my first time as being a Grammy member. And I was wondering, who is that guy that all of these people are surrounding? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm new school. I'm only 35. So, you know, I know his songs, but I didn't know him personally. Mm-hmm. And they were like, that's Gene Chandler, the Duke Earl. I'm like, well, go get him. They're like, girl, we can't go get Gene Chandler. You got to go over there and see if he'll take a picture with you. And when I went over there to him, you know, I said, hello, Mr. Chandler, how you doing? I'm Tomiko Dixon. He said, yeah, you Willie Dixon's granddaughter. Come here, baby. And he just cuffed me up. We hugged, took pictures. And that was my first, I would say, paparazzi moment here in Chicago, seriously. Because every camera just turned on us and was like, click, 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 click. Yeah, so I work for J.B. Ross & Associates, and that's one of Gene's lawyers. So through J.B. Ross & Associates, Jay's like, hey, Gene has a new wine that he's working on, so call Gene and help him with his wine.
Okay.
And it went from wine to nonprofit, which is Project Happiness, and now his street naming ceremony. So it's more things to come. Yes.
And do you promise you will be back to tell us all about the not-for-profit? We really want everyone to know that.
Yes, but we need Mr. Chandler to promise that he'll come back, speak on his not-for-profit.
Well, you know, I have my own 501c3.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And that's what we want you to share with our audience.
Yeah, I just got through feeding people for Thanksgiving.
Okay.
So I should have a big smile on my face. I do every year because I know some other people who wouldn't have had it.
Right.
Got it because I gave it. So I always have a big smile.
Okay.
And my next one is Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
That's where the toys, clothing, Christmas trees, and turkeys with a basket of food.
Okay.
That go along with it for Christmas.
Well, we're going to close out today's session.
So we have the Gene Chandler Duke of Earl street naming, which is December the 3rd, 12 o'clock noon. Be there sharp, you guys. Okay, we're going to be there with all Gene's close friends. I'm sorry, all of the Dukes.
Okay.
Close friends and family, industry, media. Hopefully we'll get all of Chris Radio there. And we're celebrating the Duke, you guys.
Right.
And we're coming back with a wine, too, in the future called the Duke of Earl Wine.
And everyone.
I'll have a big poster up there showing the wine.
Okay. And we're closing out with what selection today, Tomiko?
Well, we're closing out with my most favorite song, aside from the Duke of Earl and Rainbow, which is Groovy Situation.
Okay.
That girl?
Yeah.
I'm going to make a man if it takes all night. Can you dig it?
Can you dig it?
Okay. Well, Chicagoland and our global audience, we want to thank you for tuning in today with our wonderful guests, the Duke, Gene Chandler, Tomiko Dixon, granddaughter of Willie Dixon, and nominee. Thank you all for joining us today. Have a wonderful, blessed holiday season. And we promise to be back. We can't wait for you to come in.
I promise.
All right. Bye now.